2. The function of myth, cult, and meditation. In his life form, the individual is necessarily only a fraction and distortion of the total image of man. He is limited either as male or as female. At any given period of his life, he is again limited as child, youth, mature adult, or ancient. Furthermore, in his life role, he is necessarily specialized as craftsman, tradesman, servant, or thief, priest, leader, wife, nun, or harlot. He cannot be all. Hence the totality, the fullness of man, is not in the separate member, but in the body of the society as a whole. The individual can be only an organ. From his group, he has derived his techniques of life, the language in which he thinks, the ideas on which he thrives. Through the past of that society descended the genes that built his body. If he presumes to cut himself off, either in deed or in thought and feeling, he only breaks connection with the sources of his existence. The tribal ceremonies of birth, initiation, marriage, burial, installation, and so forth serve to translate the individual's life crises and life deeds into classic impersonal forms. They disclose him to himself, not as this personality or that, but as the warrior, the bride, the widow, the priest, the chieftain, at the same time rehearsing for the rest of the community the old lesson of the archetypal stages. All participate in the ceremonial according to rank and function. The whole society becomes visible to itself as an imperishable living unit. Generations of individuals pass like anonymous cells from a living body, but the sustaining timeless form remains. By an enlargement of vision to embrace this super-individual, each discovers himself enhanced, enriched, supported, and magnified. His role, however unimpressive, is seen to be intrinsic to the beautiful festival image of man, the image, potential yet necessarily inhibited within himself. Social duties continue the lesson of the festival into normal everyday existence, and the individual is validated still. Conversely, indifference, revolt, or exile break the vitalizing connectives. From the standpoint of the social unit, the broken-off individual is simply nothing, waste. Whereas the man or woman who can honestly say that he or she has lived the role, whether that of priest, harlot, queen, or slave, is something in the full sense of the verb to be. Rites of initiation and installation, then, teach the lesson of the essential oneness of the individual and the group. Seasonal festivals open a larger horizon. As the individual is an organ of society, so is the tribe or city, so is humanity entire, only a phase of the mighty organism of the cosmos. It has been customary to describe the seasonal festivals of so-called native peoples as efforts to control nature. This is a misrepresentation. There is much of the will to control in every act of man, and particularly in those magical ceremonies that are thought to bring rain clouds, cure sickness, or stay the flood. Nevertheless, the dominant motive in all truly religious, as opposed to black magical ceremonial, is that of submission to the inevitables of destiny. And in the seasonal festivals, this motive is particularly apparent. No tribal rite has yet been recorded which attempts to keep winter from descending. On the contrary, the rites all prepare the community to endure, together with the rest of nature, the season of the terrible cold. And in the spring, the rites do not seek to compel nature to pour forth immediately corn, beans, and squash for the lean community. On the contrary, The rites dedicate the whole people to the work of nature's season. The wonderful cycle of the year, with its hardships and periods of joy, is celebrated and delineated and represented as continued in the life round of the human group. Many other symbolizations of this continuity fill the world of the mythologically instructed community. For example, the clans of the American hunting tribes commonly regarded themselves as descended from half-animal, half-human ancestors. These ancestors fathered not only the human members of the clan, but also the animal species after which the clan was named. Thus, the human members of the beaver clan were blood cousins of the animal beavers, protectors of the species and in turn protected by the animal wisdom of the wood folk. Or another example, the hogan or mud hut of the Navajos of New Mexico and Arizona is constructed on the plan of the Navajo image of the cosmos. The entrance faces east. The eight sides represent the four directions and the points between. Every beam and joist corresponds to an element in the great hogan of the all-embracing earth and sky. And since the soul of man itself is regarded as identical in form with the universe, the mud hut is a representation of the basic harmony of man and world, and a reminder of the hidden life way of perfection. But there is another way, in diametric opposition to that of social duty and the popular cult. From the standpoint of the way of duty, anyone in exile from the community is a nothing. From the other point of view, however, this exile is the first step of the quest. Each carries within himself the all. Therefore, it may be sought and discovered within. The differentiations of sex, age, and occupation are not essential to our character, but mere costumes which we wear for a time on the stage of the world. The image of man within is not to be confounded with the garments. We think of ourselves as Americans, children of the 20th century, Occidentals, civilized Christians. We are virtuous or sinful. Yet such designations do not tell what it is to be man. They denote only the accidents of geography, birth date, and income. What is the core of us? What is the basic character of our being? The asceticism of the medieval saints and of the yogis of India, the Hellenistic mystery initiations, the ancient philosophies of the East and of the West are techniques for the shifting of the emphasis of individual consciousness away from the garments. The preliminary meditations of the aspirant detach his mind and sentiments from the accidents of life and drive him to the core. "I am not that, not that," he meditates, "not my mother or son who has just died, my body which is ill or aging, my arm, my eye, my head, not the summation of all these things. I am not my feeling, not my mind, not my power of intuition." By such meditations, he is driven to his own profundity and breaks through at last to unfathomable realizations. No man can return from such exercises and take very seriously himself as Mr. So-and-so of such-and-such a township, USA. Society and duties drop away. Mr. So-and-so, having discovered himself big with man, becomes indrawn and aloof. This is the stage of Narcissus looking into the pool, of the Buddha sitting contemplative under the tree, but it is not the ultimate goal. It is a requisite step, but not the end. The aim is not to see, but to realize that one is that essence. Then one is free to wander as that essence in the world. Furthermore, the world too is of that essence, the essence of oneself and the essence of the world. These two are one. Hence, separateness, withdrawal, is no longer necessary. Wherever the hero may wander, Whatever he may do, he is ever in the presence of his own essence, for he has the perfected eye to see. There is no separateness. Thus, just as the way of social participation may lead in the end to a realization of the all in the individual, so that of exile brings the hero to the self in all. Centered in this hub point, the question of selfishness or altruism disappears. The individual has lost himself in the law and been reborn in identity with the whole meaning of the universe. For him, by him, the world was made. O Muhammad, God said, hadst thou not been, I would not have created the sky.